Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, on Christmas Day 1859, a group called the Victorian Acclimatisation Society, in a bid to help settlers feel more at home here in Australia, decided to release 24 rabbits into the wild. And we all know how well that turned out, don't we? Invasive species, be they plant or animal, have been part of our landscape since the first fleet landed in 1788 and have done immeasurable damage to native populations of animals and their habitats. Cats and foxes together have pretty well the highest rate of destruction between them, but rabbits, cane toads, carp and a whole host of others don't have a much better record either. It's estimated that all the pests, weeds and diseases in Australia cost agriculture $11 billion a year, with plants doing the most damage. Across the ditch, New Zealand have announced they're aiming to get rid of all predators in their country by the year 2050. It's a hugely audacious project, but one that many of its backers are convinced can and will succeed. But could we ever hope to have a predator-free Australia? And what would it take? Tonight we're exploring our predators and how well we've responded to invasive species and what the future holds. Our guest is Dr. Andy Shepherd. He's a Senior Principal Research Scientist from the CSIRO. He specialises in invasive species management, plant biosecurity and terrestrial biodiversity management. He's also an Adjunct Professor at Charles Sturt University. Andy Shepherd, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Suzanne.
How are you? First up, how would we describe an invasive species? Where do we draw the line?
Look, so invasive species are generally animals, plants or diseases that have come into Australia from overseas and are causing some form of economic, environmental or social harm.
And it's fair to say, isn't it, that basically since the first fleet turned up that they have been pouring in and arriving in various ways, means and vehicles?
Yeah, look, you talked about the Victorian Acclimation Society. There was a strong encouragement both in New Zealand and Australia in the early days of the colonies to introduce species to make the colonists feel at home. And really the floodgates were open for, you know, almost 150 years before we started to realise the error of our ways and realise that a lot of these species being introduced weren't innocuous but were having a huge impact on the native flora and fauna.
So how many of those were actually very deliberate attempts, as you said, to make people feel more at home? What are some of the species that we can thank the early settlers for?
Oh, so, look, certainly rabbits are one of them. Foxes, too, were introduced to try and invigorate a fox hunting pastime in Australia. Obviously, the pet animals like cats that escaped as feral animals. A host of ornamental plants were brought in, which then subsequently became weeds in Australia, but affecting both agriculture but also the environment. The majority of weeds that were brought in were actually brought in deliberately. So it was really to make them feel at home. But unfortunately, the impacts were much worse than that.
Mm. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that plants actually do an enormous amount of damage. I think when we think about invasive species and predators, a lot of our minds would immediately go to something like the rabbit. But plants are responsible for an incredible amount of damage, aren't they?
Yeah. So, look, we have about almost 3,000 exotic plants in Australia. So a lot to choose from. And about 10% of those cause significant harmful impact. A lot of them are harmful to agriculture. You know, you mentioned the direct cost to agriculture, and that's because they are plants that are very well adapted to agricultural systems, you know, which Australian native plants weren't adapted to. So they've done very well in the broad areas and different types of agriculture that Australia's cultivated. But there are also a lot of plants from around the world that have invaded our native ecosystems and cause big monocultures that really do change those ecosystems. And a lot of that's to do with the fact that they were introduced themselves without their diseases or natural enemies, insects that fed on them. So they were able to, they had an advantage over the native species.
Now, some of those plants would be ones that we actually like to have in the backyard, wouldn't they? I remember a campaign a few years ago saying, look, plant natives, get rid of the jasmine, all those other things that smell pretty and look English, because they're doing damage as well.
Yeah, look, a lot of the peri-urban weeds you find are pretty much garden escapes. So things like Tradescantia or periwinkle, you know, you can see those along roadsides. So, a large number of them have jumped the garden fence, and a lot of those were deliberately introduced.
So can we put a finger on how many native animal species we've lost in Australia because of exotic predators?
So Yeah, there's very good data on extinction rates. There are, in terms of extinctions, we've lost 27 mammals since 1788, but about 22 of those are estimated to have been caused by probably feral cats and foxes. There was a large period in central Australia where there was a wave of small mammal marsupial extinctions. And the analysis was put down to the straw that broke the camel's back mm-hmm. were the introduced exotic predators. And we're now seeing across northern Australia, so Northern Territory, Kakadu and Cape York, we're seeing another massive decline in these native marsupials, which is, and the finger is very clearly being pointed at cats.
Now, you said, 22 of that 27 due to feral cats and foxes. What about the other five?
Oh, they were just so extremely rare, or were hunted by man themselves. So, mm-hmm. We know the thylacine was pretty much hunted out by humans rather than by feral animals. So, so those are just some of the early ones. But pretty much all of the most recent ones are due to, in some part, to introduce feral predators.
And what about the plants? Do they actually do damage in terms of impacting our native animal species?
So I don't think so. I don't think there's any strong evidence to suggest the plants are affecting our native animals. They clearly, in some areas, dominate the species in those habitats, which means that, some of our native marsupials, which are dependent on diverse native species, have become less abundant. But in terms of direct impacts, it's more predators affecting our animals. But the plants are certainly affecting our native flora. We have many threatened native plants that are affected directly by these exotic weeds.
All right, so we've mentioned cats, we've mentioned foxes. What else would you put high on the hit list when it comes to the animals that are destroying our native wildlife?
So, look, rabbits are certainly up there. I mean, the rabbits out-competing bilbies has been well known for some time. Though rabbits are generally considered to be more of an agricultural pest, but they certainly have impacts on native species. But once you get into our rivers, carp, and you mentioned carp, but also tilapia in northern Australia are introduced exotic fish, which are building up in really large numbers in those rivers. And there are also predatory fish like redfin perch in our river systems too, which will predate on native fish. Our understanding of what goes on in rivers is nowhere near as clear as it is on land, but certainly the impacts are enormous for those species. Cane toads, you mentioned, is another big one spreading across northern Australia. It tends to be disliked in Australia because it's big and ugly. Its environmental impacts on a few species are certainly well documented, but there's quite a lot of evidence now to suggest that once cane toads have been around for a while, a lot of the native fauna adapt.
Oh, okay. Well, that is good news then. But what, do they push through certain areas, have that negative impact and then leave the area behind to recover slowly?
Yeah, so the cane toads, when they move into a new area, come in an advancing invasive front with very high numbers of cane toads, and particularly what's most notable are really large cane toads. But once cane toads have been in an area for, say, 10 years, their size tends to decrease back to, something, a fairly normal size for a toad. Their density goes down, and it looks like a lot of the native animals just adapt to living with them. So it's one we love to hate, but it's also one that the environmental impacts are often a bit exaggerated.
Our guest tonight on Nightlife is Dr. Andy Shepherd from the CSIRO. We're talking about predators in Australia. What would it look like if we could follow this New Zealand dream and have an Australia that was completely free of predators? What kind of paradise would you paint a picture of for us?
Oh, well, I mean, at the moment, we're really primarily protecting our native fauna by either putting them on islands where there aren't any predators, or there's a lot of good work by the conservation NGOs putting up large predator-free fences to be able to keep predators out and allow the native animals to do well without them. There's even one in Canberra, at Mulligan's Flat, where they've introduced bettongs. And the evidence suggests on these islands and inside these kind of mainland islands protected by predator-free fences that the numbers of native animals increase to very, very, very high numbers when they're protected from these predators. So if we could remove some of these key predators, the abundance of our native fauna would increase and people could appreciate them a lot more.
So what do you think of New Zealand's goal to be predator-free by 2050? Is it achievable?
Is it achievable? That's we'll have to wait and see. So it's there is the focus of Predator Free New Zealand 2050 is on trying to remove four of the dominant predators. So these are things like weasels and stoats and rats that have been affecting their native birds. New Zealand doesn't have many native mammals apart from bats and seals and so on. So it's primarily to protect their native birds. It's a bold strategy with prime ministerial support, and it's going to take a long time. But there is, I've talked to New Zealand scientists that said that they estimate in order to achieve it, they're probably going to need about $9 billion in investment. And at the moment, New Zealand government have given them about $25 million. So they've got a long way to go. And there is also recognition by the scientists that in order to achieve that target, we won't be able to do it with conventional control strategies. We'll have to think about some of these new options.
So has New Zealand committed to any strategies yet and got started?
Oh, there's certainly a program underway in which they're funding a lot of activity. The government has put an independent committee together, a board to oversee the investments of money, which represents large public interests. So it's not being left to the scientists. And they're certainly cracking on with key pests like stoats and weasels and rats to try and possums. Australian possums is another big one high on the hit list of New Zealand.
Oh, we sent them over, did we?
Either that or they brought them in themselves. I'm not sure of the history, but they're causing huge amounts of impacts, not only to forests, but also, again, there can be predatory on native birds. So they're doing a lot of work to try and eliminate possums from certain parts of New Zealand.
All right. So given the money, do you think they can do it?
Time will tell.
Right. Not going to put money on that.
No, I wouldn't put money on. I certainly wouldn't put my money on it. I mean, I think there are technologies being made available now, as you mentioned in your introduction, that are potential game changers and could effectively eradicate widespread pests and other invasive species, predators and other invasive species. But their introduction is still far from sure. They're quite controversial and there need to be a lot of public acceptance before you start using them. Without them, I think it wouldn't be achievable.
All right. Well, as you've brought that up now, let's bring up the gene editing concept at this point. Just explain what gene editing is and how it would work in a situation where you were trying to reduce or eliminate a population of predators.
So, gene editing itself has actually been around for quite a while. Australia has been one of the global leaders in using gene editing to try and manage invasive species. CSIRO, my agency, had a program over 15 years that was trying to come up with carp constructs, what we call daughterless carp. They would be carp whose all their progeny would be effectively male, and that we would be able to introduce those carp into river systems to be able to drive populations male and therefore much more susceptible to extinction. The trouble is that sort of conventional gene editing requires that you need to be able to get your modified organisms in a high enough abundance in the population that their genetics are inherited into the whole population. And under, you know, we all know that we inherit half of our genes from each parent, and therefore, in order to get gene editing into the environment using this conventional approach, you really have to release very high numbers.
So it's not going to work just to inject it into a couple.
No, but having said that, the real game changer over the last 3 years has been the development and recognition that gene editing can be included in a way where its inheritance into the progeny is 100%. In other words, all of the offspring from a particular mating carry the gene construct, and that's a process called gene drives, where the genes that we want the genes that have been developed to effectively reduce the vigor and fitness of these pests can be driven into all of the offspring, and then down through generations can, for example, potentially turn whole populations of sexually reproducing pests and predators male and therefore drive them to extinction. However, all of these technologies are GM, And as we all know, GM is still a very controversial technology, particularly in the context of releasing it into the environment.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, one of the arguments will be about, you know, playing God. Are there particular concerns that scientists have about the use of this technology? I mean, you know, would it have the potential to go rogue?
Oh, there is a lot of concern. I mean, the scientists, Kevin Esfeldt, who's one of the famous scientists from MIT in the US, who was involved in developing the technology, is now leading a strong campaign, both in the literature and publicly, around concern that people might think that this kind of technology can just be released into the wild. The significant risk that everybody recognizes is that while you might want to drive cane toads extinct in Australia, there are native cane toad populations in South America, and if ever one of your genetically manipulated cane toads was released or got over to South America, it would also drive the native populations potentially extinct. So all of these, the use of these technologies has to be done in a very controlled way. And the gene drive mechanisms are still under development. So we may have, you know, we could in 5 to 10 years' time have much safer gene drive systems to use, which might be a lot more palatable.
Now, obviously, in the days, I'm sorry, I think we both need a bit of a cough break there. I think I've been working you a bit hard there, Andy.
That's all right.
You know, in the days before we had widespread awareness of the problem of bringing introduced pests in, you know, pests were travelling hither and thither. You mentioned the idea that, you know, if we have cane toads who we've, you know, edited their genes or they're part of a gene drive, that, you know, maybe they'll go to South America and that will create problems there. How much are these pests still travelling around the world? Have we managed to stamp a lot of that out, or is it still very, very common?
Well, I think we're in a much better situation than we were 20 years ago. Globally, the recognition of, so Australia and New Zealand have been aware of the large environmental and social and economic impacts from invasive species for well over 100 years because we saw those impacts early on. Movement of, you know, the massive increase in tourist movement and commodity movement and world trade has meant that invasive species have now gotten much into any part of the world you want to put your finger on. And so there's much better global recognition that invasive species movements is a threat to our social fabric and well-being. And therefore, there are a lot of, you know, largely built on the lead that Australia and New Zealand developed, there are a lot of restrictions now on movement. But having said that, as trade is and people movement is still increasing logarithmically, the number of species moving around the globe is still probably on the increase.
I think you only have to look at the resurgence of bed bugs, don't you, which have been travelling everywhere with the increased travel around the world.
Yeah, but as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these were deliberately introduced. Now at least we can stem the flow of deliberately introduced ones. The species that the governments tend to be most worried now are what we call the hitchhikers, the ones that come in because they're attracted to lights, or they come in because they're associated with contamination of particular commodities we might import.
So you think that while gene editing is probably going to be necessary if, for example, New Zealand's going to achieve its aim or we could ever dream of being predator-free, it's still not really at the point where anyone's touching it. I mean, or is anyone? Is anybody using something like a gene drive at this point?
So, look, you know, I work for the National Science Agency in Australia, and our job is to really understand the potential for these new technologies while at the same time exploring the risks and the public acceptability. So we're doing a lot of work around understanding these technologies and engaging with social scientists to understand what the concerns are and whether or not that's just the acceptability side. And then there's the primarily the gene drive mechanism is a theoretical concept. It's never been applied. So, with containment facilities that we have available in Australia, like the Australian Animal Health Laboratory, we can potentially trial some of these technologies inside a high containment facility to see whether they might work before even considering going into the field. So there's a lot of work to be done, even before you decide on maybe which gene you're going to modify and whether or not you can generate a gene construct.
I think even those high security facilities have problems. I remember, what was it, Khaleesi virus escaped from Wardang Island off South Australia much earlier than anyone meant it to, back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, well, that was, again, an escape from an island where the island itself was considered to be a semi-quarantine. That by releasing it on the island, it wouldn't be able to escape. But the research hadn't been completed around how the virus might get off the island, and it turned out that the blowflies feeding on the dead fly carcasses were able to carry them onto the mainland and spread it off. So yeah, you need to understand all of these risks before you try and do anything in the field. But having a containment facility at least allows us an opportunity to trial and see whether, in theory, they could work.
This is Nightlife on ABC Radio. Our guest is Dr. Andy Shepherd. He's from the CSIRO. We're talking about invasive species in Australia and really with New Zealand looking at the idea of being predator-free by 2050, exploring the question of, is it something we could realistically aspire to here in Australia? Barry in Mount Isa, a very good evening to you.
Hello from Mr. Barry Byrne from Mount Isa, Northwest Queensland. Basically, my query was, I know where invasive pests are a very bad problem and all that sort of thing. What's your guest's viewpoint in relation to domestic animals and domestic pets?
All right, Andy, we know that cats in particular are very controversial, aren't they?
Oh, they are. And Barry, thanks for your question. I mean, I myself own two cats, so I understand the context of this. But I think in Australia we can manage the pet issue effectively in the way that we ensure that the pets at home are neutered, so they can't go out and breed with the feral populations. As long as we can keep our domestic pets separated from the feral populations of the same species, it becomes a very manageable problem in terms of us allowing us to enjoy our pets without affecting in any significant way, the Australian biodiversity.
That's the ideal, isn't it, though, Andy? Because the debate about what to do with domestic cats is a particularly ferocious one, with people blaming cats for thousands of bird deaths, if not far more. And we're still not at the point where we are controlling our domestic pets properly, are we?
No, not completely. We don't really have the technologies to prevent all escapes from domestic circumstances into the wild. But Australia has feral populations of many of these, cats and foxes and 25 other feral populations that are self-sustaining. So effectively, they don't need inputs from our domestic animals to be able to continue to spread or do their harm. If we can get on top of the feral populations, then I think we've really managed the problem and people can enjoy their pets.
All right. Well, that's encouraging to hear for all those cat owners in particular who are always being told, do more, I've got to do more. John has given us a ring. Hello, John.
Hello. Yes, my question really is about a grass. It's an invasive grass. Now, I'm in a small farm. This grass is called Paspalum notatum. That's its technical name. Sometimes they call it Baja. It's a little grass. You can mow it, and within 2 days, it'll shoot up a new seed. Little bunny ears pop up. It's all on the footpaths. It seems to take over. It leaves a root mat of about 3 or 4 inches deep and takes away any other grass. I think it might have been brought in from America, but I'm not sure. Does Andy know anything about that?
I'm not sure, Andy, if you're an expert on every single invasive plant, but are you familiar with that one?
No, I'm not familiar with that one, but we have, of the order of 50 or 60 highly invasive exotic grasses in Australia, and some of them are real game changers. So, for example, gamba grass in the Northern Territory are changing the fire regimes in the savannas and turning what are tree-dominated savannas into effectively African grass-dominated savannas. And buffel grass in central Australia is having huge impacts on fire regimes and indigenous community, bush tucker and so on. So there are many of these grasses and many more than, unfortunately, we have resources to try and tackle.
How do you tackle an invasive grass?
Well, the way we've been tackling our weeds over the last 100 years or so is using classical biological control, and that is going to the native range of these weeds and finding highly specific either diseases or insects or arthropods that feed on them and bringing them in. Because as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these weeds get the upper hand because they've been introduced without any of their natural enemies. And classical biological control was first used in Australia in 80 or 90 years ago to control prickly pear cactus, and was highly successful. And since then, we've had almost 70 weed biocontrol programs, and we're certainly very keen to start a biocontrol programs against some of these weedy grasses. There is one, I think, against spirobolus grass in Queensland, but the grasses have always been a bit elusive.
Okay, so your rate of success in clearing those out hasn't been great.
So we haven't really been given the opportunity to tackle grasses. Grasses was as a target was always concerned because, you know, most of our agricultural production comes from cereals, which are also grasses. But of the 69 biological control programs against weeds that we have run in Australia, you know, about two-thirds of those have been successful. So it's still a highly successful approach that we still use widely in Australia.
What about the use of herbicides?
Well, herbicides have been with us since, you know, the 1950s. That's when the chemical revolution happened. But now we're finding that most of our agricultural weeds are developing some form of resistance to herbicides, so they're becoming less and less effective. And on top of that, we're also recognising that a lot of our pesticides actually cause some form of environmental or human harm, and therefore they're increasingly being taken off the market. And the capacity to find new ones is also appears to have ground to a halt. So I think the days of chemical control are rapidly coming to an end, and we'll need to rely back on our classical biological control approaches, but also some of these new gene technology approaches to try and manage these species into the future.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, gene editing and gene drives, do they have the potential to be applied to grasses?
The constraint about gene technology is that the plant has to be a sexually reproducing plant.
Right.
And a lot of our weeds are vegetative. Things like blackberry, everybody knows, is pretty much a vegetative weed. So it depends on the target. And grasses, of course, are wind pollinated too. So that means that, your GM pollen will blow to the four corners. So there are all sorts of risks, again, you have to think about before you even approach this. But as I say, we haven't really had an opportunity to tackle grasses using classical approaches yet, so that's something we'd really like to try and do.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't there a lot of controversy about some of the earlier GM crops being problematic in that you weren't able to collect the seed and grow a crop again next year?
Yeah, I think the companies that were using GM commercially had mechanisms such that the seed couldn't be collected and reused. So they had to be bought each year from the supplier. I think that was one of the big concerns around Monsanto at the time. But GM technology in agricultural systems, particularly cereals and so on, is being developed widely for things like drought resistance, as well as protecting them against pests and diseases.
Dr. Andy Shepherd from the CSIRO is our guest on Nightlife tonight. If you've got a question, 1300 800 222. Good evening, Stuart.
Good evening. How's it going?
Good. Now, you want to talk about alpine dingoes.
Yeah, I used to work for Mount Hotham Resort. Not the actual lift company, but the actual mountain. And we had a real problem with foxes back in and domestic cats. And we spent a lot of money protecting a species called the Burmese pygmy possum. And I'm proud to be a part of that. And we created what's called the Tunnel of Love, which is where they're to breed. But for me, I moved up to the Northern Rivers in New South Wales. And it was about 2.5-3 years ago, I came across a guy who had an alpine dingo. And that alpine dingo made me sort of like wonder about the value of it, because I used to have to walk along the edges of the road to ensure that we didn't have any land slippage after what happened at Spreadbow. And every once in a while I'd come across a wombat that had about 5 or 6 foxes chewing it, which is really sad. And me, myself, I just wanted the value of introducing species like the alpine dingo back into their environment, because I actually think they're probably going to do a hell of a lot more good than harm, regardless of what farmers in there may well think. I just think that it's something that hasn't been ever raised in Australia, and it's something that me, myself, I, as someone who's been on the side.
Right, Stuart, let's put that to Andy. Are you familiar with the alpine dingo?
I'm not familiar with the alpine dingo as such. I know that... Most of the dingo populations in Australia have some mixing with wild dogs. So these are feral domestic dogs. Feral domestic dogs are probably the number one predatory problem for livestock owners through New South Wales and Queensland and also Victoria, because they will attack lambing sheep and so on. And there are big programs to try and control them along in both New South Wales and Queensland using a number of techniques. So it's very hard at this day and age to be able to pick an animal, one of these dogs, and say, well, this one's actually purebred dingo. So again, it's a real challenge when it comes to trying to manage wild dogs, because at the same time, we want to preserve native, you know, near pure breed dingo populations where they still exist. But where they still exist, in my understanding, is in outback northern Australia, not in the alpine regions.
What successes have we had in the past controlling out of control introduced species? I mean, obviously we've been at those rabbits for, yep, a good 50 or 60 years with varying degrees of success, but they're still here. Is there anything that we have successfully got completely rid of?
No, look, eradications are nigh on impossible once species get widely established, unless, as I was mentioning earlier, these gene drives become, you know, the one tool in our toolkit where we might be able to achieve that. Where eradications have been successful in Australia, they've been very small, isolated infestations or incursions, and generally of certain agricultural pests. But so some isolated introductions of feral ants, for example, around airports have been successfully eradicated. But I think your listeners will also know that there's a big infestation still in Brisbane that's had many millions of dollars spent on it as part of an eradication program, and is still, while it's well-resourced, is still challenging to achieve a goal of widespread eradication.
Is there a crucial window once we discover that something has alighted here which we do not want to be here, to try to get rid of that before it takes hold?
Absolutely. Early detection and rapid response is well recognised at all levels in state and federal government and industry in being able to jump on top of some new arrivals and remove them. And that's why Australia has developed very strong policies and regulatory processes to allow government and industry to work together very well when a new pest is detected. And the classic late last year of that was white spot disease in prawns, which was detected in a river system in Queensland. And strong work by both the federal and the state governments and industry working together are moving very closely now to suggesting we've been able to eradicate that disease.
So that could be one that we can chalk up as a success?
Yes. I mean, as I say, they're achievable if you get in early, but often, because we've got such a large country, by the time we detect something, it's already widespread.
So rabbits, are we just stuck with them in varying numbers?
Well, so the approach in Australia has been one around management rather than eradication. And rabbits, we've managed rabbits now for well over 60 years. We've estimated that rabbit biological control using initially myxomatosis and then calici virus has saved Australian agriculture over $70 billion. So money well spent. I don't think the program cost more. It's probably cost more than, a few tens of millions of dollars over those 50 years. So, as I say, the classic approaches still work well, and we're continuing to work on new strains of these viruses to keep on top of rabbits. And rabbit numbers now are, you know, six or seven times less than what they were before myxomatosis was introduced in the 1950s. So again, I think we can pat ourselves on the back and saying we're suppressing some of these widespread, or at least in this instance, a major widespread pest at a continental scale and reducing its impacts.
Did the rabbit-proof fence ever do much good?
Well, there was a dingo fence and a rabbit-proof fence. I think I don't have any detail, but I mean, I think it was probably effective early on, but it was never going to be a long-term strategy that would provide benefits. So now I think the rabbit-proof fence is more a tourist attraction than it is a practical fence.
You did mention, though, that fences are being used, near Canberra, in that betong population. And I have read suggestions that, that there's something that could be used very well in New Zealand. Presumably, though, the scale of our country means that a fence is just not going to solve a problem.
That's right. They become like, the wildlife parks in Africa. You can keep the animals within fences. and people can go and visit them, but they're almost non-existent on the landscape. Whereas, you know, our diverse and small mammal, small marsupial fauna, are quite capable of living in around our big cities if it wasn't for the predators.
Now, we talked about cats. I might go to Brian, who also wants to have a bit of a yarn about cats as well. Hello, Brian.
Brian here, talking from Northern in WA.
Hello, Brian. All right, what's your concern?
Well, I'll just talk about the rabbits just for a little bit. I'm from a rabbit trapping family over here, going back in the 60s. And, the Khaleesi virus has sort of wiped them out. And I love to go and get a feed of rabbits, but I can't now. But I've seen plenty of wild cats. But now, getting back to the cats, I live in town. We're on an acre and a half block in town. And the cats are a big issue because I planted about 400 trees around because I love birds. And people put bells on them. And the council has got a law or a ruling that you've got to keep your cats in your yard. But people think because of the bell on them, they're right. But I sit out now. I'm sitting outside now, and cats come under the trees and get the birds. So I'd like to see them more control over the town cats.
Now, you mentioned, Andy, that you think that domestic cats essentially aren't a big problem, and it's the feral cats where we should be putting our attention.
Well, they're not a big... So feral, domestic cats aren't a big problem in relation to our threatened species, which are the ones that are, you know, live out in our still native communities well away from our cities. Obviously, domestic cats, you know, let's be honest, domestic cats kill large numbers of birds in our cities, but also a lot of those are Australian birds that have adapted well to city life. So, for example, in Canberra, we have huge numbers of parrots that do well, very well in Canberra because we have lots of fruit trees and nuts that they can feed on and plants they can feed on through winter. So their numbers are almost, artificially high. And yes, the cats are having some impact on those peri-urban bird populations. But that's not really the... It's not going to be a problem that's going to drive new species, some of our threatened species to extinction.
So it's all about what we're valuing here, whether it's about threatened species, in which case the domestic cats aren't a big issue, but if it's just about the sheer numbers of birds, well, yes, domestic cats are a problem.
And cats will always, they'll always be a contentious area of debate based on whether you're a bird lover or a cat lover. So that's just something we're going to have to live with, I think, as a community.
So what is being done about the feral cat population in Australia? And firstly, is it possible to put a finger on how many cats are in that population?
I don't think there are any reliable data on how many cats, feral cats, there are in Australia, though it's tens of millions, that's for sure. There are large programs in biodiversity sensitive areas around the country that are doing a lot of work to control both cats and foxes using baits and traps. There's even a bait called Curiosity, which is a highly successful
very nice,
bait for taking
yes.
out feral cats, and those programs are certainly seeing a lot of return in terms of numbers of native marsupials. The problem is that it's a constant battle. You can never stop doing it. The moment you stop those programs or take their money away, then the problem comes back. So it's an ongoing constant problem.
Brett, good evening.
Good evening.
Now, you want to talk about a South African grass in Melbourne?
Yeah, Kaikuyu grass.
Yeah, is there a particular question?
Yes.
Yeah, what's the question?
Yeah, the question is this grass has virtually taken over Melbourne grass, and it's comes from South Africa, and it came here about 25 years ago. Kaikuyu grass takes over all the other grasses.
Is that a problem, Andy?
Yeah, look, Kaikuyu grass is certainly one of the ones that's on the list of grasses that we worry about. Unfortunately, a lot of these grasses are also valued either as lawn grasses or as forage grasses for livestock. And so, again, you have a situation in which the community has to decide where its priorities are.
Mm. All right, foxes. How big a problem are they?
So foxes are, I suppose, are number two on the list behind cats because they're not adapted well to northern Australia, whereas feral cats cover the whole of the continent. Foxes stop about two-thirds of the way up.
So where's the last place that you would see a fox?
Oh, you wouldn't see a fox in Darwin, for example, and probably not in Cooktown, nor in Broome. They just can't survive those tropical climates, or they don't do well enough in those tropical climates. So they're primarily a predator of southern areas, and they're certainly very abundant. They're certainly doing a lot of damage. They're again, there's a big urban population of foxes in Canberra. Again, they're being very successfully baited. It's easier to bait foxes than cats in areas of where they threaten farms, or where they and where there are young lambs, or where they threaten areas with high biodiversity value. But again, a lot of money has to be spent to continue to manage them.
Do you see that hunting has a valuable role in controlling some of these invasive species? Wild pigs are a particularly one that I know the hunters like to get out and have a go at.
Again, well, hunting is a two-edged sword, right? So if you enjoy hunting pigs, then you don't want to get rid of them all. You want to leave enough behind for you to be able to find them easily to go and hunt them again. A lot of pig culling goes on in northern Australia for biodiversity reasons, where it's not as a sport. It's literally to manage feral pig populations for the biodiversity benefits, particularly in wetlands. And pigs will also feed on turtle eggs if they get onto beaches. Most of what I'd call biodiversity management in northern Australia is managing feral pigs. But again, we're developing a better understanding of how pigs move around the landscape, and coming up with some quite effective strategies for protecting the sensitive areas.
Let's talk about Patterson's Curse. This is the brilliant purple weed. And as a South Australian, I always used to call it Salvation Jane as a kid, because I understood that it was the last thing left when everything else died and the sheep or the cows would eat it and be saved.
Yeah, Patterson's Curse was a major weed of agricultural lands across southern Australia, so Tasmania, Victoria, New South Wales, Western Australia and South Australia, from the mid-1800s through to about 10 years ago. And again, we had a very successful CSIRO and worked with the state departments on a very successful weed biological control program, in which we released six highly specific insects that only feed on Patterson's Curse. And three of those seemed to do the job. And now Patterson's Curse, you can see it in little patches along roadsides and occasionally in fields, but it doesn't cause the blue hills that it used to. So that's another highly successful biological weed biocontrol program that Australia has had.
Can I say an aesthetic loss, though, because it did look brilliant, even though it was doing all of that damage.
Yeah, again, beauty in the eye of the beholder. I mean, it's toxic to livestock, so...
Absolutely. All right,
particularly horses.
Okay, so that idea that I had grown up with, that it was somehow some kind of salvation, not true?
So the Salvation Jane name came from the fact that in South Australia, when the summer droughts come, there was little else to feed on, but as it's toxic... If the livestock eat too much of it, it kills them anyway.
All right. Well, that wasn't much good then at all. James would like to ask about the status of fire ants.
Excellent. Go ahead, James.
Oh, no, sorry. On the SMS, he just wants to know about them. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about
them. Okay, so there are a number of exotic, we call them tramp ants as a generic term, in Australia. Fire ants are the worst one. They're the big infestation I talked about that... Still affects Greater Brisbane. There have been smaller isolated incursions that have been eradicated, and there's a lot of investment in early detection for fire ants, because they can move around the world on very small amounts of mud attached to vehicles. The program in Queensland is strongly supported by federal and state governments. I think it's just got another $400 million to try and push on through to an eradication program. And then there too, we're starting to use technologies. We're starting to use drones that can detect the heat signature of fire ant nests to be able to pick them up more quickly, particularly in the bush areas where they're starting to spread into. So again, the jury's still out as to whether we'll eradicate it, but at least we're giving it our best push.
Good evening, Tony. You've got a question about invasive grasses.
G'day. Andrew, my question to you is, who is going to control the research and development into control of invasive grasses if the government is not going to support you people? Are our governing masters aware of the importance of the CSIRO?
Oh, I think they are. I mean, I think particularly in terms of managing pests, weeds and diseases,
I mean, at the very least, you've got a huge economic ramifications of failing to control them.
The government recognises the importance to agriculture and is investing well in it at the moment. Grasses, as I said, are always a concern. A lot of our grasses that have now gone feral were deliberately introduced as proposed new, better fodder plants. So some of them are like the two classics are gamba grass and buffel grass, which are probably our two worst grasses in terms of their environmental impacts. They're certainly still valued by the great by sectors of the grazing industry. So again, you have to come. You can't take on something if you haven't got the full backing of the broad community behind you. We still, we will continue to push the arguments and measure the impacts, and there will be grasses that I'm sure that we can tackle because the harm outweighs the benefits. But a lot of these grasses were deliberately introduced for their fodder benefits and are used accordingly.
So Anti-Tony seems to be implying that, and I think the thrust of what you said was there's, you know, not, it's not a massive priority at the moment. Who is actually taking stewardship of the grasses issue?
The there are certain, certainly the Northern Territory government has considered, where gamba grass is a big problem, has considered investing in gamba grass management. It's again, it's to try and you can't hope to control these widespread grasses using herbicides. It's just gone way beyond that. And they've encroached into lots of native bush areas where the herbicides would cause harm. So really, there's until there is some clear, broad understanding across the community that, you know, particular grasses need to be targeted and control programs need to be developed, then, you know, it's, it becomes a bit of a political risk if particular politicians representing some communities push for an argument that other communities value.
Now, being a cat owner, you've opened yourself up to a couple of cat questions, I'm afraid, Andy. Hello,
that's
Peter.
Okay. I fully expected that.
Peter, hello.
Yes, hello. Look, as you said, I'm back to the problem of domestic cats killing the local birds. Andy, you said you have two cats. What steps do you personally take to prevent your cats from killing birds?
All right, so, Andy.
That's all right. Now, well, one of them's an old cat and lives inside all the time. The other one has. I use bells. I've bought some collars in from the UK that beep every time the cat moves quickly to scare off birds. And I also have a big red fluffy collar around the cat as well. And I bring the cat in at night. I bring the cat in during the day. Only let it out at night.
So what you chase it round if you hear that buzzer go off, do you?
Well, the buzzer is there to warn the bird that there's a cat in the vicinity, because the moment the cat starts to move, the buzzer goes off and the bird hears as well as sees, has the chance to see the
little warning device for the bird.
Yeah. But hey, none of these things are 100% effective.
No. Our guest is Dr. Andy Shepherd from the CSIRO on Nightlife tonight. Andy, get your crystal ball out. Where do you think we'll be in 2050 when New Zealand, if it gets enough money, is looking at a predator-free New Zealand?
So, well, we're working very closely with New Zealand around these new gene drive technologies. I don't expect to see them being released, within the next 10 to 15 years, if at all. But if those technologies do become publicly acceptable and proven and low enough risk in terms that we can manage them, I can see New Zealand and Australia working closely on applying those technologies to probably the first cab off the rank is going to be rodents on islands, because, again, they're isolated populations. And I think, we could certainly see some strong advances towards the goal of their strategy and some significant impacts on some of our widespread feral animals. But as I say, I'm an optimist, so we'll have to wait and see.
And if rodents were the first port of call, what do you think we'd move on to if that proved successful?
There are plenty of rodents, rodent problems to deal with.
Oh, okay.
There is a strong interest by Australian Wildlife Conservation to tackle cats using some of these gene technologies. They're because of the huge impacts cats have in the context of their values. Again, the risk of having a feral cat population running around that's GM, and the risk that a cat might get off onto a boat and off onto another part of the planet is a significant risk. A lot more public debate has to happen before we even consider whether or not we want to use these technologies. Before we then go down the line of, well, what kind of pests might we use them again? We may be using them one day against rabbits. Who knows? Or we may not. depending on what people want.
Yeah, and clearly there's quite a lot of work to still do on the science.
Oh, the arrival of these technologies has opened up a whole new dimension of research in how we might manage invasive species, yes.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Andy Shepherd, thank you so much for being with us on Nightlife tonight.
That's all right, it's a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.